Revelation chapter 18. Thank you, Mary.
And it's on page 323 of the Pew Bibles. That's 323 in your Pew Bibles. After this, I saw another angel coming down out of heaven. He had great authority, and his splendor brightened the whole earth. He cried out in a loud voice, "She has fallen. Great Babylon has fallen. She is now haunted by demons and unclean spirits. All kinds of filthy and hateful birds live in her, for all the nations have drunk her wine, the strong wine of her immoral lust. The kings of the earth practice sexual immorality with her, and the merchants of the world grew rich from her unrestrained lust." Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out, my people, come out from her. You must not take part in her sins. You must not share in her punishment. For her sins are piled up as high as heaven, and God remembers her wicked ways. Treat her exactly as she has treated you. Pay her back double for all she has done. Fill her cup with a drink twice as strong as the drink she prepared for you. Give her as much suffering and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. For she keeps telling herself, 'Here I sit, a queen. I am no widow. I will never know grief.' Because of this, in one day, she will be struck with plagues, disease, grief, and famine. And she will be burnt with fire, because the Lord God who judges her is mighty." And we're now going to chapter 21. "When I saw a new heaven and a new earth, the first heaven and the first earth disappeared, and the sea vanished. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared and ready, like a bride dressed to meet her husband." Oops. And finally, chapter 22. No? Okay.
"It was the best of times, it was the worst of times," wrote Charles Dickens. Well, it was meant to happen, wasn't it? And it didn't. And I'm not talking about the rugby, with England losing yesterday. 3 days have gone since we were meant to leave the EU on the 31st of October with Boris Johnson's do or die commitment to the British people, leaving him and that policy in tatters. Now, we've moved ahead slightly forward in having a deal past the first hurdles in Parliament and another flexible extension from the EU to see if we can process and move forward a little bit more. But as we all know, before anything else happens, the country now faces a general election. Goodness knows where that will leave us. Let me say from the outset, I'm not going to tell you whether I voted leave or remain, or whether which side of the debate you should be on or thinking about. But on this very momentous occasion, within this historic life of the UK, in this extraordinary and what seems a never-ending saga of hustle and tussle within Parliament as to whether we leave or remain in Europe, I felt strongly over the last 2 months or so that we should be considering those and these extraordinary events of Brexit and to reflect theologically as to what that means for us today. I suppose throughout the whole process, the basic rawest question that we have to ask ourselves is this: what are we searching for? Both in the way we voted and in the events following the referendum 3.5 years ago. What, as a country, but more importantly, what as Christians are we searching for in these times? And I think the answer to that question can be summed up in one word: certainty. Certainty in the big things of life, in the life of this country. For Brexiteers, predominantly the feeling has been about restoring government governing rule and taking back control from Europe. We want to make our own laws, our own rules, to have certain our challenges of our own High Supreme Court and not be subservient to the European courts. And we want to manage control on immigration policy. We want to keep the money ourselves for using within this nation effectively. And if we want to give state aid to a particular aspect of industry, whether it's steel, whether it's farming, whether it's car manufacturing, then we should be able to have the freedom to do that. And then there are Remainers, those who feel that we are stronger in a coalition with Europe rather than a lone small island fighting against the superpowers of the world. Yes, of course, we've been influenced by the affairs of the European continent, in which we have participated in discussions and decision-making, while at the same time also developing our own distinctive personality and worldview. And yes, we've had open borders and permits for workers of European nations, and we've benefited greatly from those resources and expertise. When they've been taking jobs that we've needed to fill in the NHS or farming or hospitality, and would not have been filled without that external input. And being part of Europe, we've also benefited from those strong trade deals within Europe across the globe. Yes, ironically, both leavers and remainers want that same goal: prosperity, security, certainty. The problem is we appear to be looking at two different types of cities, as Dickens wrote in his Tale of Two Cities. This is not a time now between England and France in the 18th century, but in the book of Revelation that we read earlier, between Babylon and the New Jerusalem. Now, let me say from the outset, in drawing parallels today between our political situation here and now and the book of Revelation, I'm not suggesting that at all that the EU or any member state nor any person within society should be seen as being dynamic or antichrist, as some writers and some people have suggested. And nor do I believe that there is architectural or symbolism within the EU that could or should be seen or viewed as dynamic in nature. So in the light of our Brexit debate, let us look at these two cities as highlighted in our readings today, to see what they might be saying to us as Christians. In chapter 18 of the book of Revelation, John has this vision of a fall of Babylon. That's this great superpower of a city. And he laments over it. "I saw another angel," he says, "coming down from heaven. With a mighty voice he shouted, 'Fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great.'" See, Babylon was such a powerful city that it appeared totally secure. It appeared to have everything it needed to sustain itself. But even the great Babylon was not impregnable from disaster and total destruction. And of course, historically, the real city of Babylon fell in the 6th century BC, as parallel passages from Isaiah 13 and Jeremiah 50 and 51 echo. So what went wrong with them? when everything appeared to be going so well. Well, chapter 18 gives us some clues, as if summing up the persecution, summing up for the prosecution of what went wrong. He writes, "For all the nations are drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from the excessive luxuries," or wealth, or power, "of her arrogance." And didn't they have such great wealth, this city of Babylon? Their merchants had so many things, a silk and scarlet cloth, all sorts of cotton and wood, items made of ivory, bronze, iron, marble. Their cargoes of cinnamon and spices, of incense, of myrrh, of frankincense. They had wine, they have olive oil, they had fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, carriages, and human beings sold as slaves. Babylon the Great was a powerful nation and was indeed very, very rich. But recession had come to their land and hit them hard. The merchants, today we would call them traders, businessmen, whatever, were interested only in the loss of their profits. They had many products to sell, and some very fine and expensive items, but nobody wanted them. As we would say today, the bottom had dropped out of the market. And even the basic of commodities were not now being traded anymore. The wine, the olive oil, the fine flour and wheat. And to make matters worse, even the Babylon traders dug deeper and deeper into the depths of despair, trying to trade the lower classes, the slaves of the city. But even they weren't being bought. And notice here the decreasing value of products that they were starting to trade. Starting with what would normally be the most expensive items, and then down through the list in decreasing value of products. And where do we find? Right at the bottom. Below the cattle and sheep. Below the horses and carriages. It's almost as if they considered the slaves which they traded as nothing more than things which they could trade like any other commodity. Of course, in ancient times, people took on slaves, and often for granted, rather than prohibiting the practice that we would today. Owning of slaves was seen as normal place and practice. But if you read the Old Testament laws, it contains very strict measures to ensure the slaves' rights were made clear and that the slaves were being treated as human beings, and no different from anybody else, free or slave. And even in the New Testament, Paul, in writing to Philemon, doesn't attack the institution of slavery, but he does tell Philemon that he must regard his slave no longer a slave, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother. So one of the biggest problems of this great city of Babylon, in essence, this huge divide between rich and the powerful and those who lorded themselves over everything with their own profits and gain. And then you've got the poor, the destitute of the city, those who were treated with total contempt and whose value was even lower than the cattle in the fields. In our own Brexit debate, we have heard similar cries and action from both sides. For the leavers, see little or no wealth in the hard-working foreign nationals working in many jobs that the Brits can't or won't do. And they almost want them expelled to their country of origin. Almost back to the mantra that we've heard so often and last year, send them back, send them back. They want to see them banished from these lands at the earliest possible moment. But the problem with that is that so many of these so-called foreigners have no country to go back to. They were born in the UK, so are genuinely British. Leaving without a deal, all economists agree that certainly in the short and medium term, the UK will be considerably poorer, with UK export trade dying a death, and importing goods, including food, will see increased shop prices. And one criticism that's been levied at this government is that actually the pain will not hit all peoples, nor the rich, but predominantly the poor. For the Remainers, they have a slightly different argument. The people had voted at a referendum that they would want to leave the EU, yet 3.5 years down the line, their promise has still not been granted to the people. And arguments and blocking tactics from generally the Remainers, Parliament has stalled and thwarted the government at every turn in order to try and deliver a fair Brexit without a profit for the few, but across the nation. Maybe there is also a sense in which some of the rich Remainers want to remain in Europe in order to maintain their profitability on the current trade and continue to exploit workers, minimum wage workers, foreign nationals, everything done in the pursuit of sensual self-indulgence. And still that cry goes up, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Babylon here in the book of Revelation represents the dead end streets of humanity's attempt to build their culture apart from God. Yes, it has the appearance of being the paradise for humanity, always carved for and longed for as a people. And I suppose it's no coincidence that its gold and its jewels recall those of the New Jerusalem to which the city is compared. Babylon has exercised its authority over the nations and received their wealth, but in reality, its activity and trade were counterfeit, doomed to be exposed by God in the final judgment. The fact that much of Babylon's condemnation appears to stem from its self-indulgence should surely hit us hard as a modern consumer culture, where there is a continual and constant search for more and better to satisfy our real and sometimes imagined material needs. So I've wondered occasionally during this whole Brexit debate where God has been in our thinking. Where has God been in our discussions? Where has the sense of justice been in our arguments, in our thinking, and in the country's actions to this point in time? I think I've come to the conclusion about the passages today that the most worrisome thing about all of Babylon was that it looked so close to the New Jerusalem. God had created a good world in which we're meant to enjoy life. God delights in the beautiful, wonderful things of the earth, and he's given them to us to also partake. Babylon promises all the glories of the Garden of Eden with its abundance of fruits, but in reality, it does so without the intrusive presence of the Father. And even so, the good things of God are turned into false gods, false services, which bind people into sin. So is there an answer to all this? Is there an alternative vision of life that we can take hold of? Or are we to continue to flounder in the cesspit of sin's humanity's actions with everybody else? as the cry goes up to announce the fall of Babylon, so also the cry to those who are faithful, come out of such wicked ways. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven. There is an alternative way. And we don't and shouldn't abide in the ways of sinful humanity, being tainted by their sin. We need to dissent from the world's philosophy and goals of self-indulgence, of pleasure-seeking, of taking advantage of our neighbours, in the broadest sense of the meaning. John saw that new vision, a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw a holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven from God. There is an alternative way of life, the new Jerusalem. There is a sense in which this prophetic prophecy is the end of times, but in another sense, it can also become a reality for us now. We pray in the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, through our actions, in what we say, in how we live our lives. We can bring God's kingdom here on earth now. We can make a difference. We can have a hand in bringing about the new Jerusalem in the here and now. Not only with God as our focal point in that society, we can replace this city of Babylon with God's kingdom. As some of you will know, I was born in one of the early formed garden cities. The garden city was founded by a series of principles developed by Ebenezer Howard at the turn of the 20th century, 1899. He wrote in his book, Tomorrow, A Peaceful Path to Real Reform, of his vision of how the advantages of the most energetic and active life, with all the beauty and delights of the country, may be secured in perfect combination. And so he built these garden cities on the principles of a strong vision, of leadership, and above all, of community. The town developments were meant to be a method of urban planning, of which were self-contained communities, surrounded by green belts containing proportional areas of residence, of industry, and agriculture. A community built and controlled and benefited all in total reliance with one another. The New Jerusalem that Revelation describes is not just another and better garden. The New Jerusalem is a garden city, a way of life similar to the Babylonian dwellers, but where the bedrock and focal point is not on themselves, but on God, of his worship, and the fair treatment of all to the detriment of no one. A city built for the community, self-reliance, yet with all the benefits of other cities, but working in harmony with and for itself. There is a definite thought of the return of the Garden of Eden, of Genesis, with its river flowing through it, and the tree of life with its fruit-laden branches, which Revelation describes as leaves for the healing of the nations. Humanity can once more walk in peace with God and have no fear. But we cannot but notice the parallels between this city of God and of the New Jerusalem in Revelation and that prophesied by Isaiah all those centuries ago in Isaiah 65.
See, I will create new heavens and a new earth. I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and of crying will be heard in it no more. Never again will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. The one who dies at 100 will be thought a mere child. The one who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. They will build houses and dwell in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. My chosen ones will long enjoy the work of their hands. They will not labor in vain, nor will they bear children doomed to misfortune, for they will be a people blessed by the Lord, they and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, and dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Now, doesn't that sound a great and fantastic place to live? A life of peace and tranquility, of joy and contentment, of fun and laughter, of fairness for all. But above all, God is there in the midst of them, walking in his garden city. For the last several years, the British people have striven to find a solution to Brexit in an attempt to find out that which we strive for, and that other countries and peoples throughout history have had similar struggles and wars over it. As with all modes of life, our great position of authority in the world, the more we have, greater our responsibility. And for us as Christians, that is so also. We have a huge responsibility to work and direct our lives towards the ends that will glorify God, that others may see and be drawn to the risen Christ in whom we serve. For each one of us, our responsibility is practiced in the way that we express our love towards our neighbours. Unlike the people of Babylon, where our actions are often exploitative in nature, we need to strive and campaign in these Brexit times and in the days ahead for a better way of mutual benefits, where there is a fair exchange of goods and services, and for the treatment of all workers in a just and fair way, whether they are UK nationals or citizens from another country. But for ourselves, where profits and success become the gods of the people of Babylon, surely we need to shake off our own man-made idols which try to bind us, always remembering that all of them, all of life, it comes from God and is subject to his approval and disapproval. Some might think that the country of the UK is invincible and great, as in the times of old. But man's assessment of itself is nothing in the pronouncements of God. Even Babylon the Great was no match for God. And we will never win if we pitch ourselves against him. So that must also mean that ultimately our true loyalties in life are revealed in the deeds themselves. Those of us who commit ourselves to the way of Jesus must strive to be above reproach, both in our lives and in our ethics. This surely is the tale of two cities. But which city are you wanting to reside in? And which city does Britain want to eliminate and which city does Britain want to emulate as we face the election of a new parliament? Do we want a Babylonian type of city with all its wealth and prosperity, but which is focused on itself and the few rather than God? Or do we want to be in this new Jerusalem, a city, a country which strives for inclusiveness and fairness, where we can share all the glories and riches and abundant fruit that God has provided for us as we live in partnership and companionship, not just with ourselves, but also with Him?